Hey guys, welcome back to our second episode of A Matter of Crime. This is an historical true crime podcast, and I am Allie.
I am Chris.
And we are going to be telling you about the massacre at Mela. And this is an incident that took place during the Vietnam War. It is one of the most horrific things that I've ever studied in my undergrad education. And the reason that I want to talk about it is because a lot of times things like this, especially that have to do with the American military and government, get swept under the rug. It's important for young people today to understand what has gone on in our history, what our government has been responsible for, because a blindness to these incidents is only going to help further and excuse this kind of behavior in the future. So if you know what to look for, if you know what's happened, if you're educated on our past, then there's a better chance of you being able to stop these kind of things from happening in the future.
Well said. Well said. I agree. There were so many things that were completely FUBAR about Vietnam, and I think most everyone knows what that means.
Fucked up beyond all recognition.
Correct. And the massacre is just a perfect example. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the mindset of the American soldier during that time. How could this even happen? How could, you know, an officer give this order to kill these innocent people, and so on and so forth? We're going to give you a little backstory and fill in behind it of how we even got involved in Vietnam. Why were we there? What the hell were we doing there? You know? It's an interesting story. It's a sad one. So, Allie, start us off.
On March 16th, 1968, Captain Ernest Medina led his infantry company in an assault on the village of Son Mai along the central coast of South Vietnam as a part of his mission to find and destroy a battalion of the National Liberation Front, which was the name of the Northern Vietnamese Army.
Or VC, as the slang was used.
The slang was
politically incorrect, I might add. Yes. But let's use real terminologies, you know.
They were called the Viet Cong. I don't like calling them that because it has kind of a negative connotation to it. And I don't wholly believe anything that they did at this point was necessarily wrong. But we'll get into that a little bit later.
And I will comment on the whole missions to find and destroy. They were sent out on search and destroy because there weren't your traditional battle lines as in, you know, okay, my enemy's over there. I see them. We're going to fight. Those, you know, like in World War II where you would have that, or even World War I where you would have trench warfare. And, you know, that wasn't the case. This was the first time the Americans had ever faced guerrilla warfare.
Your enemy was not clearly marked. They did not have a swastika or any kind of thing on their uniform that would tell them apart. They blended in with everyone else in the country, and there was zero way to know if that person walking down the street was a villager or a soldier who wanted to kill you.
True. And also, they were ingenious in their attack methods and so forth. You know, they were taught never, ever to frontal attack or attack straight on a force bigger than them or that they couldn't easily overwhelm, A. And B, they were the just king of camouflage. And we can get into that a little bit later, but they would hit, and, you know, stick and move, like a boxer. They would hit you and disappear, obviously with a network of tunnels and underground passageways that they had. They would literally disappear out of the jungle. And early on in Vietnam, we really struggled with that. Our military did, but these poor kids had to learn how to fight, you know, with basically no knowledge of the terrain. But go ahead, Allie. I'm sorry. I'm passionate about that.
You're fine. I definitely appreciate the insight from someone who knows more about the war and less about the politics. So I'm definitely the political.
It's all bullshit, but they shouldn't there. But
I'm the political side of things, I think.
True.
In this, and you're the military strategist side of things.
But anyway, let's get back to, okay.
Okay, so we're back to March 16th, 1968. We've been in this war for a hot minute at this point. This is basically the height of combat. And like I said, we're going to look for the National Liberation Front. And one of the hamlets within the village of Son Mai was called Milai. Son Mai, excuse me. There's...
Okay, explain to our listeners about what a hamlet was considered, or do you want me to? Well, okay, a hamlet, for us to, quote, win the hearts and minds and protect the South Vietnam people, we built these, basically, they were internment camps. You know, we're good at that, Hawaii, Japanese. Anyway, these internment camps, because that was the only way we felt we could protect them, and literally walled, cut out of the jungle, squared off, for lack of better words, barracks for these, you know, people to live. But anyway, the hamlets is what they called them.
So this group of infantrymen were operating under the assumption that the villagers of Milai would be away at market, or so they were told. So Captain Medina had planned this super aggressive sweep through the area and ordered his men to destroy everything and kill everyone who resisted. So by the end of the day, the American forces had reportedly killed 347 people, but the Vietnamese actually estimate it to be closer to 504 people. All of these people were Vietnamese women, children, and elderly people.
Yes, not. I don't believe there was any soldiers whatsoever, and there was also a horrific amount of rape involved.
So, Charlie Company is what this group of soldiers were called. They were also led by a lieutenant called William Callie. And Callie had been down through it. I mean, he had been in the war basically since the beginning. He had seen all his friends get killed by the NLF, the Northern Liberation Front. And he had developed a very intense and specific hatred for the Vietnamese. He basically no longer viewed them as people, and he personally shot, beat, and tortured unarmed civilians in front of his men all the time. So his attitude was like wildfire, and it spread throughout the other soldiers, and with every subsequent loss, their hatred grew.
And you have to think about this. This is something that wrap your mind around. Imagine you being a senior in high school, graduating, and then the next thing you know, you're in a jungle somewhere, scared, out of your mind, and you're
8,000 miles away.
Yeah, you're going to emulate what your one authority figure does. You know, the fear ran hand in hand, you know. It's fight or flight kind of thing. But anyway, go ahead, Allie. I'm just saying, think about that. 18 years old.
I mean, and there were some that were as 17. Young as 16.
Yeah, oh, I agree. I'm saying kids. Kids.
At this point in the war, not to get off track too much, but we were piling up bodies and bodies that we didn't really care if you lied to get into the military. So some people who were young and ignorant of the actual politics of the war thought that that was their job, and that's what they needed to do, was to go sacrifice their life
for their country. Exactly. And be a hero.
Just
got it.
Like their dad and their granddad, blah blah, right. Blah. Okay, so zero checks and balances throughout Charlie Company. Captain Medina never once corrected the behavior of Callie or his men. Once, actually, a little anecdote, a private knocked an innocent villager into a well, and Callie aimed down and shot the man with his pistol rather than save him. So that just gives you kind of an insight into what kind of person we're talking about here. He would encourage his men to use villagers as human mind detectors. So you can see this in a number of Vietnam War films. Basically, what they would do is they would go to fields or rice paddies or wherever.
Well, there were known minefields.
Right, yes. That they suspected that the NLF had buried landmines. And they would take these villagers and point their guns at them and make them walk out into the field.
To, yeah, clear a path for his soldiers to be able to cross the field.
Right, so...
Not just to kill them, you know, in their mind, they was justified, you know what I mean?
Well, because it helps that they didn't think that they were people.
No, they were objects to them.
Exactly.
No one's arguing that point with you.
It's no different than to them than throwing a rock out there and
always try to, you know me, always try to have, you got to look at the whole picture, and they were trying to survive, not that any of that was okay or right.
No,
that's complete bullshit what they did, but that's why they did it.
Right. And I will note that in a lot of, if you do develop an interest in Vietnam after this and you want to go watch some films, I might leave a couple of recommendations later on for you to check out. But in most of these where you do see this action occur, a lot of times it is the Vietnamese soldiers themselves that you see doing this. Even though it was really a tactic that was employed by Americans more often than not. So,
true.
By the time, oh, and they would shoot them if they didn't go out into the field. So it's not like you just couldn't go. It's either be shot or,
well, you know,
have like a 1 in 10 chance of not stepping on a landmine. So by the time that Callie's platoon got to My Lai, they were down to 27 of their original 45 men. Before this attack, they had a briefing on My Lai for the soldiers, and they were led to believe that the people in the village were either a Viet Cong soldier or a communist sympathizer, and that they were basically to destroy this village and all its resources because anything that was left behind, the Vietnamese army could use to feed and support their troops. And, you know, we don't want to give them any resources or any help. So Callie and Medina at this point had ordered every villager that their men saw executed. These villagers who were actually getting ready for market that day didn't panic or run away because they weren't soldiers. They hadn't done anything wrong. But they were herded into the hamlet's common areas. I have a few anecdotes from that day which are a little hard to hear, so just a little fair warning on that. These are kind of rough, but Harry Stanley, who is a machine gunner from Charlie Company, said that during the U.S. criminal investigation inquiry that the killing started without warning. He first observed a member of the 1st Platoon strike a Vietnamese man with a bayonet. And then the same trooper pushed another villager into a well and threw a grenade in after him. He saw 15 to 20 people, mainly women and children, kneeling around a temple and burning incense. And they were all praying and crying. And they were then summarily executed by shots to the head. Another account says that a large group of approximately 70 to 80 villagers was rounded up by the 1st platoon in Zom Lang, and excuse me if I'm not saying that right, but they were led to an irrigation ditch east of the settlement. All the detainees were pushed into the ditch and then killed after repeated orders issued by Lieutenant Callie, who was also shooting into the pit with all of the people in it. Private First Class Paul Medlow testified later that he expended several M16 rifle magazines. How many bullets can a...
Oh, it depends on the size of the magazine, but, you know, anywhere from 16 to... Gosh, I'm not exactly sure how many an M16 during that era held, but, you know, upwards of 20 bullets to a clip, I'm sure, at least.
Right. So, several.
Yeah,
That would be a lot. He recollected that the women were crying and saying no VC, as in no Viet Cong, and were trying to shield their children. He remembered that he was shooting into women with babies in their hands. And since he was convinced at the time that they were all booby-trapped with grenades and were poised to attack, Private First Class Dennis Conti, a witness for the prosecution, which, like I said, we'll get into later, told of one especially gruesome episode during the shooting. A lot of women had thrown themselves on top of the children to protect them, and the children were alive at first. And then the children who were old enough to walk got up, and Callie began to shoot after the children. And there is actually a very famous photograph, because there was a reporter there that day. So there is a very famous photograph of a little girl who looks to be 5 or 6 years old, who is, running half naked down a road, and 3 or 4 grown men with rifles are following her. And minutes after that photo was taken, she was shot. That's our cat. There are several photos from this incident, which you are welcome to go look at, but I will warn you that they are very emotional and very disturbing. So, but again, these are real people. This is really what happened. And it's not easy to shy away from the truth. So, another testimony goes, I walked up and saw these guys doing strange things, setting fire to the hutches and huts and waiting for people to come out and shooting them, going into the hutches and shooting them up, gathering people in groups and shooting them. As I walked in, you could see piles of people all through the village, all over. They were gathered up in large groups. I saw them shoot an M79 grenade launcher into a group of people who were still alive, but it was mostly done with a machine gun. They were shooting women and children just like anybody else. We met no resistance, and I only saw 3 captured weapons. We had no casualties. It was just like any other Vietnamese village. Old Papa Sons, women, and kids. As a matter of fact, I don't remember seeing 1 military-aged male in the entire place, dead or alive. So the men began burning huts, killing livestock, and dumping out food stores and basically killing anyone that they saw. There were a few men who took some prisoners. At the end, they loaded all 50 of the remaining civilians into a ditch. Old people, women, and children, and even a Buddhist monk were all shot, but not before some of the soldiers raped the women and young girls. So there were estimated around 20 women who, well, I say 20 females who were raped. Some of them were as young as 10 years old.
Jeez.
The...
I mean, that... All right, stop for a minute. That right there, as a grown man, I just... It saddens me, and it also... I'm curious of what... How your mindset... That you could do that to another human being. I know that they are made into objects in their eyes. That, you know, hey, they're going to kill me. They're, you know, I struggle with the fact that, you know, how they could do that. I struggle with that. I do. I just can't even believe it's real, but it is real, and I know it's real.
How else could you justify murdering people? Murdering people goes against our basic human nature, right?
Okay, that's another podcast, but...
Murdering people goes against normal human beings' basic human nature.
Okay.
And it's like a switch goes off in your brain. We have this fight or flight response that's naturally built into us as animals. And a switch goes off in your brain, and... You have to, out of self-preservation, and this is seen all throughout history, you have to view these people as non-people. You can't view them as human beings, because if you do, then you start to feel compassionate, you start to feel bad, you start to feel remorseful for your actions, because you're literally decimating an entire population of
human beings.
Exactly. So if you don't view them as people, then why would you feel any guilt for raping True. One of them?
It wouldn't matter.
Exactly. It's just in the same way that settlers shot natives and killed the children, and slave masters would breed and auction off babies of their slaves for True. Money.
Now, you know, and of course, if, you know, if a 10-year-old was in a jungle or rice paddy shooting at me, bullets whizzing at me, I would respond, but I do still feel that, you know, and like you say, just out of self-defense or survival, and then I would, of course, be changed forever, you know.
Exactly. And at this point, they've probably killed no telling how many people. And like I mentioned earlier, they've seen so many of their, like, fellow soldiers be yeah. killed by these people. So they had had plenty of time to dehumanize them mentally. So it was nothing to dehumanize them physically. So this massacre, as horrible and absolutely mind-numbing as it is, finally ends when a flight crew led by Warrant Officer Hugh Thompson intervenes. He sees the murders from his helicopter and immediately gets angry and lands the helicopter, and he told the door gunner, who was named Lawrence Colburn, to cover him, and if he saw the Charlie Company begin to fire on any of the Vietnamese in the bunker, that he was ordered to shoot them down. And this is a major move for somebody in the military, to order another military man
True.
To kill his own people. I mean, these people would have died by friendly
fellow
fire.
Fellow soldiers.
Right, exactly.
Say that.
I mean, these people would have died by friendly fire. He could have been court-martialed. He could have been sentenced to jail time. And, you know, this was a huge thing for him to do. But he saw what was happening very clearly from the air. So he lands and he confronts Lieutenant Kelly, who told him it was none of his business. And Mr. Thompson persuaded other pilots from that who were flying helicopters in the area to evacuate the rest of the civilians. And he eventually calls the Lieutenant Colonel Frank Barker, who calls Medina and orders him to stop the killing. And that is pretty much the end of the massacre, but it's not the end of our story, because these men have to come home, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they...
And they're going to face harsh penalties.
Because there was a reporter there, and the reporter saw and took photos of everything that happened. And there was a lieutenant colonel who witnessed the piles of dead bodies everywhere. So how did... We're going to take a brief second and kind of talk about how these soldiers got to this point mentally during the war. So just super, super quick, I promise. I do tend to talk a lot, but super quick. The Vietnamese was ruled by the French for about 100 years. In 54, the Vietnamese formed the National Liberation Front and defeated the French and got permission, which is so strange, to elect their own leader and form their own system of government. And when they did this, that's when they were divided into North and South Vietnam, and they would be reunited after the election. And that is when the United States intervened and decided that they couldn't have this once colonized nation showing its independence, because that would be a message to other nations around the world that we colonized at the time. And I say we, meaning colonial parties, which were France, Great Britain, Spain, Portugal, and America, to name the major ones. But yeah, we couldn't have anybody else get any crazy ideas of revolution or independence. So we had to put a stop to that. So we instituted our own leader in southern Vietnam, and he basically started all this anti-communist propaganda, and that gave us the perfect end to move in and start our I guess, advancement into moving in and destroying the Northern Vietnamese army and...
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, had to stop communism at all cost.
Exactly.
That is the big bill of goods that they sold to the American people, and everyone grabbed a big spoon at first, and just gobbled it down.
Yep.
Because we were so scared of the Cold War, of the communists, of dying, you know, how close we came to an actual, you know, nuclear war with Russia and the Cuban Missile Crisis and so on and so forth. You know, you had kids in elementary school doing duck and cover. That's an interesting thing you can Google at some point. Think about that. You're in the fifth grade, and you, instead of practicing a fire drill, you're practicing a drill to in case of a nuclear attack from, of course, big bad communist Russia, the Reds. You know, and they would show the maps and would have North Vietnam in red, and the potential if we didn't stop, and what was all going to be red. And so it was all fear tactics. And
exactly.
We're good at it. Sorry, I'm a little passionate about that.
No, it's fine. So the war kind of summarily begins, and it goes through three presidents, Eisenhower, then Kennedy, and then it gets to Johnson. And Johnson is one bloodthirsty military supporting son of a bitch. And he decides that he's, you know, we're the big tough Americans. We won World War II, so we're going to go there and stop him. And so he basically launches full-blown attack on Northern Vietnam, and that's when we really, you know, go in strong is after 63, after Kennedy was assassinated. So,
and that's why we lost so many lives, with our arrogance and overconfidence.
Yeah.
But we got humbled fairly quickly.
Exactly. And so just some of our tactics. So the saying goes that the fish rots from the head down, right?
Correct.
And so it wasn't just Lieutenant Calley and, you know, these people who started all this. It goes to the generals, and then it goes to the, you know, Secretary of War, and it goes to all these people who are directly related to how our soldiers viewed the Vietnamese people. Our country was very cruel, and I think from the beginning didn't, I would say just the administration didn't view them as people and didn't care what happened to them and didn't care how they won the war. When we figured out that the Vietnamese were gaining ground on us and were better at this whole terrain and mapping it and fighting on it and guerrilla warfare, we started to get a little creative. So in 68, the U.S. found that their traditional tactics that helped them win in Germany and Italy were not effective against guerrilla warfare. This was not our country. We didn't understand, once again, how the land works or how the Vietnamese use it to their advantage. So we created some super fun new weapons, one of which, not so new, was napalm. But napalm is a incendiary chemical, which means that it is used to set fire to things. But if you jump in water, fire goes out, right?
Well, yeah. Well, the napalm was a gasoline based and a gelatin, and it would stick to things and catch everything on fire, you know.
Right.
But you could smother it. Yes.
Yeah. You could still put it out. So what we figured out that we would do is infuse the napalm with this substance called white phosphorus. And white phosphorus burns water. And there is some fancy scientific term for that. But basically, white phosphorus will attach to the water in anything. To your skin, to any organic matter. And if you jump in the river, it's just going to burn hotter. So when we would drop this napalm on people and then they would jump in the water to try to put the fire out, they would keep burning. We also developed cluster bombs, which you helped explain to me.
Well, they're it's one large bomb that has, and it depends on the size, but let's just say 100 bomblets is what they're called, and it's a it's a device that's just, I mean, it's horrible, but it's ingenious as well. It's an anti-personnel, meaning it is to affect troops on the ground. And
it doesn't just blow up one spot.
No, I was explaining.
Sorry.
With 100, why would it blow up one spot? But anyway, what it does is that explodes, and then it spreads it out, say, like shotgun pellets, but they're the size of, you know, bigger than a softball, and they're filled with explosive and shrapnel, and they all explode. So there's one big explosion that sends 100 mini explosions.
In all directions.
In all directions. And a very, very, very effective weapon for troops that are camouflaged or hidden in the jungle and so on and so forth. And napalm worked very well as well.
Right. And one, we talked previously about the Vietnamese being very good at camouflage and utilizing their terrain as cover, and basically is one of their best weapons. And so we decided that we had to get rid of all this cover. We had to get rid of this foliage that they were using to hide from us so well. So we used what was called Agent Orange, and it was a defoliant that we would put in helicopters and
actually C-130s. Helicopters couldn't carry as much as the bigger planes, and they would be like a giant crop duster going over the jungle canopy. And of course, it didn't just kill foliage.
So that's why he's here. So it would kill literally any organic matter that it came into contact with. So birds, animals, bugs, and
everything.
Leaves, trees, literally everything. It looked like a barren wasteland by the time they got done with it. What we didn't know at the time,
or did we?
Or didn't care.
There you go.
Was that this chemical, Agent Orange, if you basically came within 100 miles of it, you would develop any number of diseases. So
cancer, primarily.
Our soldiers who were in charge of distributing Agent Orange, I mean, this stuff was getting dropped down on their heads while they were walking.
Oh yeah, yeah. Many jungles. Soldiers were sprayed with it, and you know, many more were affected in the loading and
right.
And it wasn't just Agent Orange too. There were many different types of defoliants. That's the one that just, you know,
that worked the best.
That got the most publicity.
Well,
anyway, but it was very effective.
Right,
yes.
And so what we. All these soldiers started coming home with brain cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, stomach cancer, pretty much any kind of cancer that you could imagine, somebody had it. And a
lot of soldiers would say and have been gone on record that it was, you know, oh my God, I made it through a year and didn't get killed by the VC. I got killed by my own government once I got back home. But of course, you know, because the cancers and the things and all the issues it caused and birth defects, of course, took time to start happening. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen, you know, in six
straight
months.
Away, right.
But, you know, in a few years, just crazy amounts off the charts of certain types of cancers in, you know, they started really looking at in the different platoons and stuff and the people who handled them, you know, who handled the chemical,
yeah.
You know, and that's a very valid point.
So, you mentioned birth defects, and I would just like to add that you can Google pictures of Agent Orange. I wouldn't if you want to sleep tonight, but you can Google pictures. You can Google Agent Orange on Google Image Search, and there are children still today who are being born with birth defects because of Agent Orange in Vietnam. It's really terrible. Sorry, I'm going to move on. So, like we said earlier, these boys were as young as 16 years old. They were so impressionable, and they saw the cruelty that our government inflicted upon these people from the top down. And how could they not, you know, get to this point when that they absolutely hated these people? And
yeah, and she was going to mention, Allie was, about, there's a Ken Burns is a well-known documentary guy, and the one he did on Vietnam, there's some interviews with of course soldiers that were served, and he said this one soldier, I apologize for not knowing his name, but he made reference to the fact that the only thing that came close to his hate for them was his fear of them, of the VHC, because they were excellent soldiers, and no one that fought over there would tell you different. They were excellent soldiers. They had been fighting their, I mean, just generation after generation.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just crazy, but they had to survive, you know, dehumanize them. And not that that makes any of the atrocities okay. I'm not condoning that. I'm just saying that if I'm going to sit here and be honest with our listeners, who's to say I wouldn't have snapped too at 17?
And we're not necessarily, just a disclaimer, because there are still many, many Vietnam veterans who are out there that absolutely deserve your respect and admiration. We are not anti-veteran.
No,
we are anti-military complex. I'll put it that way. It's too much to go into right now, but we do not blame the individual soldier. We do not, of course, if you raped someone, if you murdered innocent women and children, you should be held accountable for your actions. But we do not blame the average, you know, on the ground soldier for their actions for the most part. It's the military that got us into this, and the military is, and the government is,
I was gonna say, not just, yeah.
The military being the United States government,
right,
is solely culpable for the atrocity that overall was the Vietnam War.
All right, speaking of culpability, what happened to the soldiers that were held responsible? Let's hear. I'm waiting to hear the stats on the, I'm sure, you know, fury that rained down on them for their murder of innocent women and children. Go ahead. All ears.
So the leaders of the Charlie Company tried their best to cover up the massacre.
Shocker.
As one does. The first reports said that 128 Viet Cong soldiers and 22 civilians had been killed, despite only finding three weapons in the whole village. General Westmoreland, who deserves an entire medal of fuckery because he's just an absolute shithead, congratulated Charlie Company for its amazing victory against the Viet Cong in My Lai. Initially, Medina was written a letter of commendation by Colonel Orrin Henderson, despite the fact that Henderson was fully briefed and aware of the situation that happened the previous day.
Let me get this right. A Colonel Henderson, Orrin Henderson,
mm-hmm,
was briefed that about the actual events, right? Yes,
that 500 civilians were murdered.
Okay, found just, what, a handful of weapons and 500 innocent. And he wrote a letter of commendation,
mm-hmm,
for Medina.
Yes.
Okay.
All
right,
because,
I just had to make sure I heard that right.
Because, and this is not in my notes, but this is just a little side note, that the United States spun this, and they posted all kinds of newspaper headlines that, you know, we had killed all these Viet Cong soldiers and there were no casualties. I had a history professor that actually told me this anecdote, and I wish I could remember all of the people's names that were involved. I'm so sorry. I should be more informed on this. But I just remember him saying that when Colonel Henderson was originally told about the goings-on at My Lai, he hung up the phone. And he was told, you know, that there were no casualties, and there were 300 some odd killed. And he apparently commented to a reporter that happened to be there that they must have all been women and children. Because he knew that if there were zero American casualties and 300 something dead Vietnamese, that they were innocent women and children.
Yeah, there's no way there wouldn't have been some casualties.
Exactly.
Absolutely not.
Exactly.
Well, I mean,
so he fully knew what was going on.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
So this happened in April of 68. November of 69,
mm-hmm,
a year and a half later, this famous reporter, he's now famous, Seymour Hersh, broke the real story of what happened at My Lai after several interviews with Callie, because like I said, there was a reporter there that day, and while he was kind of silenced and pushed to the side and people discredited him at every turn.
Was he a reporter for Stars and Stripes, or do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Because if he was an actual reporter for the Army, of course they shut him up.
No, I don't think he was, but...
So he was a civilian reporter?
I think so, yes.
Okay, I'm going to look into that. I'm curious now.
Please do, because I don't remember.
Well, it's kind of important, but anyway. Sorry. Seymour Hersh broke the story. Right.
Hersh broke the story after he had had several interviews with Callie, and the story was picked up by Time Magazine and Newsweek, which were like the two biggest news headlines of the time.
Huge circulation. Huge. Right.
That's the entire country. That's not, coast to coast,
exactly. North to south, didn't matter. They were everywhere.
So the crime gained enough attention, enough media attention, and public outcry, and Callie and 25 other men were court-martialed on charges of premeditated murder.
Okay, go on.
Okay, so 14 other officers, aside from these 25, were also court-martialed over charges of conspiracy to cover up these murders.
All right, right direction. Continue.
However, only one, Colonel Henderson, who we mentioned before, was actually tried. So he was the only one out of the 14 officers who actually stood trial.
But I'm sure he was convicted.
He was acquitted in December of 71.
No. Wow. Who'd have thought that would have happened?
Don't act surprised.
Yeah.
It gets better.
You gotta be shitting me here.
It gets better.
Come on.
So... Callie faced a 4-month trial for the murder of these civilians. Like I read to you earlier, there were plenty of witness testimony, plenty of people who, you know, said what they saw. There were pictures. Despite the fact that he constantly blamed his actions on following the orders of his commanding officer, Medina, Callie was convicted and sentenced to life in prison in March of 71.
One man.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
So you got one, and he's pretty much like the main bad guy, right? Like, he's the main villain in this whole story. But, yeah, he was convicted, sentenced to life in prison. So, you know, good job. He's in jail. Good job, you know, military court people. 2 days later, President Nixon, super stellar, outstanding guy, ordered Callie released from military custody in Fort Benning, Georgia, and put under house arrest pending his appeal.
Well, that's normal for someone who murders 300 people to be under house arrest, sure.
Seems normal to me.
But, I mean, that's fine. I just, what?
He just gets to go home and wear a fancy ankle bracelet.
Don't even think they had those back then.
And watch his TV. And then just, you know, make a peanut butter sandwich.
Got it.
While there's 500 dead Vietnamese people in a ditch somewhere.
Okay, got it. Okay. So, what happened?
Super fine, normal. Later that year, after his appeal, his sentence was reduced from life to 20 years. So he still gets 20 years in jail, right? Like,
I'm not buying it.
At least it's something.
No.
No?
No, he got out
things,
of that too.
Things never end that nicely. Mm-hmm. Callie served 3.5 years of house arrest before he was paroled by the Secretary of the Army, Howard Calloway. Calloway was quoted in the New York Times in 1976 stating that Callie's sentence was reduced because he honestly believed that what he did was part of his orders. A rationale that directly contradicts the standards set at Nuremberg and Tokyo, where we told German Nazi soldiers that following orders was not a reasonable defense for committing war crimes.
No, we put people to death, hung them, because that was not a defense.
But they weren't Americans.
Message! I'm just kidding.
So there you have it, folks. A man goes to war and leads 27 other people on a massacre of 500 people. And he gets 3.5 years of house arrest.
So I bet he was caught up on his soap operas, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I don't...
He was a, you know, as the world turns aficionado, I'm sure, at that point. House arrest, huh?
Did they have Dallas then? Is that a thing in the 80s?
That was a nighttime... Well, I guess he'd still be on house arrest. Yeah, yeah, they had... That was the 80s, yeah. This is...
79 was the end.
But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
No, then where is it? But so...
Twixt here and there.
As you can see, we are kind of speechless at the results of this. When I was studying this in undergrad and I read that, I was absolutely infuriated. And this happened 50 years ago. I'm just, my mind is absolutely blown that you can murder that many people and admit to it and have witnesses and photographs. And you get 3.5 years of house arrest. But that is our American military industrial complex for you.
Alrighty.
Seems pretty just. No?
Well, it is in their eyes.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, you know, because he's
well, you know, one American. Hand washes the other. That's just how it works. Ugh. Good old boy network. Still alive and strong today.
Yep. That's it. We really don't have much else to say besides that.
Well, like we have plenty more to say, but nothing about this, because I'm going to go scream into a pillow.
I do want to recommend some great Vietnam movies to you. I'm sure Chris has a couple of recommendations as well. Some of my favorites are Platoon.
Okay, these aren't historically correct.
No.
They're entertainment.
Okay, some of them are entertainment, but I will challenge you to watch these movies and understand that they came out, some of them during Vietnam, some of them after Vietnam, and decide for yourself what these movies tell the American people about the war and what you think.
Yeah, form your own opinion.
Exactly. Like, watch these movies and decide if you feel that they are an accurate representation or if they are purely for entertainment or, you know, do your own research.
I personally prefer, this is just me, I prefer to watch documentaries where they have actual interviews with soldiers who were there and fought in, you know, 1, 2, and 3 tours, you know. Good Lord, I couldn't imagine 3 years over there. But,
okay, well, speaking...
That's me.
Speaking of a movie that you will get some of that insight and be entertained all at the same time is Full Metal Jacket. And Stanley Kubrick actually did work with Vietnamese soldiers, the soldiers that fought in Vietnam, and he knew a great deal about it to make that movie. That movie is not super far off at all from anything that happened.
Well, Apocalypse Now is another good one. He actually served, what's his name?
Brando.
No, what? No, no. The guy who made the movie.
I don't know who made the movie.
Are you serious?
You don't know who made the movie either.
I know, it just temporarily left me.
This is what our lives are like. No. Okay, wait, list of movies really quick. Sorry, we're getting off track because we really love a lot of these movies and we basically have them all on DVD. So, Platoon is really good. It has Charlie Sheen in it. He's furiously Googling to see who made that movie. Apocalypse Now has Marlon Brando, who's also the Godfather.
Yeah, but he's not in it hardly at all.
Well, no, but he is pretty good. Okay. You can watch Rambo, which is not necessarily a Vietnamese war movie, but it gives you some insight into how Vietnamese soldiers were treated once they got home. Like I said,
Francis Ford Coppola made Apocalypse Now.
Okay. Who also made The Godfather. So it's a great movie. Deer Hunter. Great movie.
That's a really mental,
yep.
I mean, it, you know, it is.
It screws with you big time. Big time. Trying to think of any more. If you want to watch some good propaganda films, there's The Green Berets that has John Wayne in it.
Yeah, that's propaganda. Seriously. Platoon. Okay, sorry, but I know. Platoon. Oliver Stone. He served in Vietnam. He was the it was written and directed by him, and it's considered an anti-war film.
It is.
I know. I'm just saying. And he, you know, he literally served in it, in the war. So, you know, that's firsthand. But
so what have we said? We said platoon, Full Metal Jacket, Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, Green Berets.
Deer Hunter really focuses on the psychological damage that it did to people when they come back, when they came back home.
Yeah.
And being ostracized, you know, as far as, you know, baby killers and, you know, not, you can't do that. You know, there were some bad apples, yes, but not every soldier ever, you know, not everyone over there did horrific and war crimes.
Platoon gives you some good insight into that too. Platoon's a good dichotomous movie about, you know, the good versus the bad as far as soldiers go in Vietnam.
Okay, no more ums. We're out.
Yeah, I really can't think of any more, but there are plenty out there. So, like I said,
thanks for listening.
Go do your research. Somebody's trying to rush me out of here because he's ready for bed, guys.
No, I'm not.
It's 8 o'clock, so he's ready for bed.
112. Leave me alone.
All right, guys, thanks for listening, and we will be back next week. Be sure and check out our Facebook. What's the name of our podcast?
It's A Matter of Crime.
A Matter of Crime, a historical true crime podcast. That is our Facebook page, so go follow it and be kept up to date on our postings, our recording days, and give us case suggestions.
Love to hear them. Love to read them.
Absolutely. And if you, our podcast is now live on iTunes, so if you like it, go give us a 5-star rating and let them know that you appreciate it. So maybe we'll...
Let them know?
iTunes, they look at the ratings. Okay. That's how their algorithms and things work.
Okay.
I don't know.
What does alligator rhythm have to do with anything?
You can if you want to. Anyways, thanks, guys.